We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, Hour 2 of the program. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson. I'm David Inge. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. And in this hour, the second hour of the show, we have a health topic for you. And, you know, throughout the year, we have physicians on the program. Every other month, we have a family practice doctor here, and we do general things. And then throughout the year, we have other physicians that look at particular parts. And we're also pleased to hear, so we're pleased to welcome back one of those. Claudia Nugent is here. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic, and she's been with us a number of times here on the program to talk about her particular area of interest and practice, and that's the whole digestive apparatus. And we've talked about a lot of different things here. We've talked about things like colon cancer. We've talked about ulcers. We've certainly talked a lot about reflux disease and about indigestion, which seems to be the signature illness of our time. And we can talk about any and all of that. And would certainly, I know she would be happy to try to answer your questions. The one thing I always say, I'm going to say it here, I always say it when we have a physician on the program, is that people need to realize that we cannot do diagnosis over the phone. There are limits as to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. But it's a good place to start. And if you have some very basic questions, I'm sure that she will do her best to give you an answer. It's a good place to start. And then if you have concerns, you need to take them up with your own physician. But you can start here by calling us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you certainly can do that. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, and having said that, I already do have an email here from someone with a question, so I will read it to you. We have someone who I believe he means that he is 50, was having a colonoscopy, and the doctor found some precancerous cells. So he was also told, and I believe this is the rule, that he had to have his next colonoscopy. Oh, I see. Okay. Let me take that back. If you have a colonoscopy, everything is cool, 10 years.
Yeah.
He had a colonoscopy. Doctor found some precancerous cells, so he was told that he should come back in 5 years instead of going 10 years. So wants to know, how common are precancerous cells, and what is the probability that I will get colon cancer?
All right. As far as the incidence of polyps, we expect to find about 23 to 25% patients that actually have polyps when we do their original colonoscopy, excluding any other risk factors, such as family history, et cetera. Once you have, we have found polyps, then you're now in a different category. So you have a little higher risk of having further polyps down the road in the future. But if you have routine screening exams, which are done then more frequently, even if you have a negative exam thereafter, so the chances of you getting a colon cancer are low as long as you continue to have the screening exams. If you don't and you've had a history of polyps, then, yeah, your risk is a little bit higher. It's not huge, but it's higher than someone that does not have any polyps at all.
Okay. So, and it sounds like from what you're saying is then if you would go with this bumped up recommendation of, say, let's take a look every 5 years, that then 5 years from now, even if you did find some more polyps, chances are that then you would remove them, and probably then that would mean that those things would not go
right
on to become cancerous.
Right. So the whole idea is with colon cancer, it's one of the few cancers that actually has a precursor to the entity of the cancer itself that we can remove, take care of through the scope most of the time. And then that precursor is gone, the lesion is gone, and nothing's there to grow anymore. And there's different rules for as far as size of the polyps that are found, the number of polyps that are precancerous, as far as recommendations for further exams. But once you've had polyps, even let's say in this patient, they had two small polyps that were potentially precancerous. They were removed, great. Next time would be 5 years. Let's say at the five-year mark, there were no polyps found at that exam. He still would be, or he or she would still be recommended to have another colonoscopy 5 years thereafter, because you're in a little bit different risk category now, because you have shown that, yes, you do grow these types of polyps.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do all polyps, if a polyp was allowed to grow and you just left it there, are all polyps going to go on to become cancer?
Oh, probably not. And I don't think I have seen any good literature nor is there any out there to actually tell us, all right, well, 100% of these polyps going to grow and become things. Mm-hmm. Your body probably does take care of some issues. Sizable polyps have already been there for several years, so it's unlikely they're just going to fall off and disappear on their own. Small polyps, maybe there might be some regression with your own immune system taking care of them. But when I always say potentially precancerous type polyps, because you always wonder if I find a little 2-millimeter polyp, it's, you know, the cell type is potentially precancerous, but is that ever going to grow into anything larger? Well, I don't know for sure. But if it's, polyps have got to start somewhere, cancer's got to start out somewhere as a small entity and then grow. So it's kind of hard to guess which are going to and which are not.
Okay. We have a caller here to talk with someone in Bloomington, Illinois. So let's go there on our line number 4. Hello.
Yes. My wife had her gallbladder removed a couple of years ago, and I just wondered, you know, what effect not having the gallbladder would have on the digestive system, you know, and what sometimes she still has some pain, and I wondered, you know, should she change her diet, or can you pretty much eat the way you've always eaten?
Well, actually, that's an interesting question. There, I've got a lot of different answers for you, unfortunately. Taking the gallbladder out appears to be fine as far as digestion goes. Your bile is important for fat absorption, but bile is still being secreted by the liver. So the gallbladder is just a storage place for that. And so you're still secreting the bile, and so every time you eat, you still have that produced by the liver, which goes into your intestines so that you still get absorption. Having the gallbladder out doesn't affect that at all, therefore, but it sometimes will cause a little bit more sensitivity to eating fatty foods. You may be a little bit more prone to having diarrhea after eating that. And in some very rare situations, some people will have diarrhea anytime they eat it all after their gallbladder is taken out. That's somewhere in the range from probably 3-5% as far as mild problems, and less than that for severe problems. And it's usually an effect of the bile irritation itself directly on the GI tract. But overall, digestion is not affected by the gallbladder being out, and most people are able to go back just to a normal diet without any problems afterwards.
Yeah. Also, I wondered, is there still a chance that, you know, some stones could develop in the liver that could get stuck in the bile duct, or is that pretty rare?
It's actually, fortunately, pretty rare. Usually it's not stones are not formed in the liver. They're actually formed in the bile ducts, which are the tubes that drain the liver. And as long as there's no obstruction to that flow or a reason for the bile just to sit in the bile duct and not drain, then it's unusual to have any stones form within the duct itself. Not impossible. There are some genetic situations that alter how bile is formed, and so you've got a different ratio of different chemicals in the bile, and that can increase the risk of bile duct stone formation. But we don't see those very often, fortunately.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. And again, other questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. So if you have digestive issues, give us a call. And here's somebody else, line number 1.
Oh, hello.
Hi, in Champaign. Yes, go ahead.
Could you tell me what the cause is of frequent and loose stools for many years with no pain?
Okay. There's probably a textbook out there that would address all the causes, because there certainly can be a lot. I'll tell you what I see the most often. What I see the most often is simply irritable bowel syndrome, which – It's kind of a poorly explained, poorly understood entity where there is just abnormal movement of the small and large intestines, especially the large intestine a lot of times. Sometimes it will be associated with crampy abdominal pain and sometimes not. Not everybody's GI tract moves the same, and some people have very slow movement and may have just one bowel movement a week. And some people have 3 to 5 a day, and those are still all considered normal, within the range of normal, as long as there are no symptoms involved with them. There's also other entities, certainly some malabsorption-type problems, and those sometimes are actually from fat malabsorption because of diverticulosis involving the small intestine. You can have malabsorption problems from something called celiac disease, which is actually a wheat or gluten allergy that affects the small intestine, and then you have some secondary malabsorption issues. There are some foods that can cause diarrhea problems. The olestra, which is a fat substitute that has become common now in some of the diet foods. Some potato chips are made with those. So you still get the taste, the feel of fat, but it's a fat substitute that doesn't get absorbed, and it causes, if you eat enough of it, some diarrhea problems and or just loose stools. What we see very commonly in patients is as we get older, most different racial backgrounds of patients develop lactose intolerance. They're probably at least 50% of patients over the age of 50 that have at least a partial lactose intolerance. And that can be variable as to how severe it is. And then some people, it may just cause some mild loose stools. Not a big deal. They go on their way. That's a short list.
Would a colonoscopy help to determine?
It can, certainly. Again, if you want to keep going down the list, there are some entities that can be picked up with colonoscopy, certain things like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. That would be a little bit unusual without any pain. There is an entity called microscopic colitis that can only be picked up with biopsies of the colon, where there's a mild protein layer that is laid underneath the lining of the colon and that decreases absorption of water and therefore causes some loose stools. There are different type of colitis issues, again, that can be picked up at the time of colonoscopy. And there are even some precancerous type polyps that secrete a mucinous, a mucus type entity that can cause looser stools. So, yes, there you go. That was a long answer again.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Let's go on again. And this next caller, we have someone in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Would it be appropriate to ask you about monosodium glutamate? It's a flavoring in foods, manufactured foods, and I've been hearing opposing opinions. Some say it's okay, and some people say it isn't.
I'll let you know what I do know about it. I know that some people don't tolerate it at all.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's MSG, am I right?
Yeah.
Is the abbreviation on that. I do believe it's associated with something called the Chinese restaurant syndrome because a lot of Chinese foods use a lot of MSG.
Uh-huh.
And it causes a flushing, almost appears like a severe allergic reaction, but it's just such a severe flushing that you feel like you're going to die, but luckily you're not going to, and then it will just eventually go away. I have not seen any literature that shows that MSG seems to be a problem for most patients if there's no symptoms from eating it. But I think some people really don't tolerate it very well. And so, you know, kind of do what you tolerate and don't what you don't.
So it's not unhealthy, except if you're allergic to it.
Yeah. And, you know, everything in moderation. My mother taught me that. And
yes.
I think those are good guidelines.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you for your help.
All right. Well, thank you. And again, whatever questions you might have, digestive-wise, our guest this morning is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. And the number, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, now I got to ask you, I've been sitting here thinking about it ever since you mentioned it. There are some people who only have one bowel movement a week? A week?
Well, it's a little bit of an extreme, but yes, there are some people that have a bowel movement every 5 to 7 days. And That's actually, if you look at the literature, still considered normal as long as they feel fine.
Oh, okay.
I think, again, that's a bit of an extreme. Another extreme is the 5 bowel movements a day. But that's just how some people are made.
Yeah. Okay. So truly, we're talking about the total range from the one end to the other. I suppose the average,
no
really,
pun intended,
most, yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. I suppose what is the true average?
Yeah, average is probably 1 to 2 bowel movements every 1 to 2 days.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
All right. Let's see. We have another caller, Douglas County. Line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've heard a term called leaky gut syndrome, and I wondered if the doctor had heard of it and what she can tell me about it.
I have heard a little bit from patients, but I have not read up a bunch on this, so I will plead some ignorance. I think some of the bowel cleansing products have promoted this. Am I right on this? Do you?
Right. It's more like a natural health thing, I think.
Yeah. The idea being that your gut leaks bacteria into your body, and that if you cleanse your bowel every once in a while, that kind of cleans things out and will decrease effects of the bacteria. I will admit that I have had limited reading on this, but I've not been a real grand proponent of the bowel cleansing, except for your colonoscopies, of course, I guess, because you have normal bacteria in your colon that are healthy. There's normal bacteria on your skin, in your mouth, even in some in your stomach to a certain extent, but especially in your colon that help with actually some vitamin absorption issues and also to keep pathogenic or bad bacteria from taking over and affecting your colon.
That's why we take the probiotics.
Yeah, you know, exactly. So those are kind of the two extremes on the holistic medicine side of things, I think. And, you know, on one side we're trying to add bacteria, on the other side we're trying to get rid of everything. So it makes more sense to me, especially since I've seen some entities where there are bad bacteria that take over, for example, after antibiotic therapy, where you may have given an antibiotic for a sinusitis problem or urinary tract infection, but of course it affects your bacteria in your colon as well, and then you end up with a bacteria such as Clostridium difficile, which is a pathogenic bacteria that actually causes a colitis. So, and part of the treatment is to try to get normal bacteria back into the gut so that this other one can't continue to take over. So I'm not a proponent of the bowel cleansing. I think even after we do colonoscopies, when we have to clean things out to a certain extent, it takes people a while to get back into the groove and get their colons moving normally again, because we affect that when we do the cleansing.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Well, what about there certainly are products and things just as sort of normal off the shelf as yogurt that are promoted for having healthy bacteria, and that's a good thing for you to have that. So, you know, have some yogurt, and there may be some other things that people are buying over the counter that actually has that claim. Is there some sort of benefit for that?
Yeah, I like yogurt. And yogurt overall is a healthy thing, I think. Whether the probiotics that are put into some yogurts or even the other probiotic therapies that are out there actually do anything to help regulate our GI tract, I don't know. If I have patients that tell me they think that helps them, and then I have no argument about it. If you feel better, again, yogurt's a healthy thing. And we even promote that, I will admit, when we have the pseudomembranous colitis, that bacteria that takes over, the Clostridium bacteria that takes over when the good bacteria, quote unquote, have been deleted because of other therapies. Whether those bacteria actually get down into the colon, because we've got stomach acids that kill them off, they've got to go all the way through the small intestine, which supposedly is sterile, and then get to the colon. I don't know. There's probably some byproducts that make it down there, and maybe that does promote other bacterial growth, normal bacterial growth. But I don't think the studies are just wonderful to support that. But I don't argue with success either if people tell me that they feel better.
Okay. So. On again to another caller. This is someone in Champaign on our line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a question. I have some polyps that have developed over the years in my intestines. I'm in my late 40s. And something I'm curious about, they would often tell me, you know, because I drink a lot of, well, historically, I drank a lot of hot coffee. And I still drink some coffee on the weekends and this sort of thing. But I drink a lot of hot tea and a lot of hot black tea as well, hot green tea, hot black tea. And I enjoy spicy food. In terms of, you know, what do you recommend for the levels to which one should drink, even, let's say, hot green tea? I just don't know if that has any effect on polyps and so forth.
Well, I mean, I enjoy the same things that you do as far as spicy foods. But again, everything in moderation. But even having said that, there are no studies that I'm aware of that say that there's any correlation between drinking hot drinks and increasing the growth of polyps. And in your situation, given your pretty young age, you probably have a genetic predisposition to forming the polyps, and it's just important to stay on top of it. The only thing that really has, and even this is a little questionable, but there are some studies out there that promote fiber supplementation and a high fiber diet, decreasing the potential for polyp formation.
Well, that's good news. I have a lot of fiber in my diet.
There, well, there you go.
Okay. One other thing, the hot coffee. I read that there's a recent study in Europe, apparently a very large study that said that 5 to 6 cups of coffee a day is extremely good for your prostate.
Oh, that's interesting.
I was surprised by that. Yeah, blown away by that. That was even in the local paper, I think.
Well, you know,
I was just kind of wondering.
I haven't seen that article. It'll be interesting to see the details on that. But I know that the coffee thing has gone back and forth for many, many years, and I remember when I was in medical school, there was a small study that had been done that suggested that coffee, increasing your coffee intake might increase your incidence of pancreatic cancer. And, of course, we medical students just about fell over dead in our tracks thinking, that can't be true. And,
exactly.
Yeah, and since then they kind of said, no, we don't think that this is true, which we all saw a big sigh of relief there. Now we've kind of gone the other extreme where they've said, well, at least 2 to 3 cups a day might actually increase your exercise tolerance. And I like to run, so it's like, yay,
right.
You know, get that coffee
good
in.
Good for your brain, too, apparently. Yeah.
I keep working with me on this, yeah. but I don't know about the prostate.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Okay, thank you very much.
And would any idea that we might be getting someone under the table here from the Coffee Roasters Association?
No, I'm waiting for that check, but I don't think it's coming in.
Well, just generally speaking, what we have been told in terms of things that people can do to reduce their risk of colon cancer. I mean, the two big things, and you mentioned one of them, is increase the amount of fiber in your diet and try to cut down on the amount of fat.
Right.
Two real basic things that are pretty easy to remember. Are we still essentially saying that that's a good, you know, in terms of general guidelines, that's a good thing to think about?
Yeah. And, you know, overall, that's just healthy for almost all body parts, circulation, your kidneys, just everything. Lots of fruits and vegetables, which, again, play into the probably antioxidants that are important, but also the fiber supplementation through those foods as well. And I'm all into, you know, do as much as you can dietarily, but our diets vary so much. That's just the way our lives are. And we grab breakfast on the run, we grab lunch on the run, and we're lucky if we sit down to supper. But if you can do a fiber supplement, and there's all kinds of them out there, I think it's a good idea, and it should promote colon health.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems that we've made some strides in dealing with colon cancer because people are more aware of it and that people are doing what's recommended, and that is we're getting people screened. So people are going for colonoscopies and so forth. But I wonder, are there, you know, you look at the number of people who perhaps should be screened and the number of people who are being screened, how are we doing? And are there still a lot of people who you would say, you know, I really think it would be a good idea if you would go and have the test, and they're not, for whatever reason, they're not doing it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of stumbling blocks, and I personally am still waiting for the Star Trek scanner that just, you know, beam up my pile of Scotty, and they're gone. But that's not going to happen probably in the very near future. And I think the stumbling blocks to doing the colon screening, which, by the way, there are studies that show we have definitely decreased the incidence of colon cancer by doing colon screening, mm-hmm. Which I think is phenomenal. There's very few cancers, I think, out there that we can say that with as far as doing screening modalities. So it's very, very important. Given that, I understand that there's stumbling blocks. Number one, to having to take laxatives beforehand, it's just kind of junky. None of them taste good. Some of the phosphate-based ones can be a little bit hard in the kidneys. You have to be careful using that in patients that have kidney disease. And so it's a challenge. Also, your colonoscopy is only as good as your prep has been. So mm-hmm. if you don't follow the instructions, or for some reason it just didn't work that well that day, and I know that happens, we can't see as well. So, and those are issues. The colonoscopy itself is not usually that bad. If you can get through the prep, the procedure, and outside the idea of someone putting something up there, which you have to, I realize, get past, but that's... The procedure itself is just not that bad. There's sedation that can be used, different types to make it much, much easier on patients. And down the road, there are some other screening modalities that will probably become used a little bit more in the right situation. Those are things like virtual colonoscopy, which is in essence an MRI or a CT examination of the colon that's a little bit more in depth. Now, there's issues with those as well. There's radiation exposure. They're done best by people that do them a lot. So that's, you know, just certain centers at this point. And they also tend not to report real tiny polyps. And so the question is, well, are tiny polyps important or not? If they're not being reported and you're suggesting another x-ray then exam then 5 years because you're not reporting smaller ones, then that's increased radiation exposure risks, and then, you know, the list goes on and on and on. But having said that, there are going to be some other modalities that come out. There's also some genetic blood screening and stool gene screening to look for polyps and for cancers, and all those are not ready for prime time yet. Those are things that are being worked on.
What about the thing that I'm sure people have heard about, this, the idea that there's this little camera that
yeah.
you swallow,
yeah.
and then it goes through there and it takes pictures
that's a pretty cool idea. That's almost the Star
that's
Trek
close
scanner,
to, yeah, it's yeah. close to your Star Trek scanner.
Except that it doesn't take care of the polyps when they're seen. But having said that, that also is only thus far ready for the small intestine. So the pill endoscopy, as it's called, is a capsule that you swallow. It takes pictures throughout the small intestine, and then we have to carry a monitor, and then we get to look at the pictures, and then you can say what's going on in the small intestine, which is not usually a polyp field. It's usually the large intestines where you want to look at. Now, I do know that there are some Japanese companies, I think, that are looking into trying to develop pill endoscopy for the colon. Part of the issue is different movement. As I said, if you have a bowel movement once or twice a week, the battery's going to die in the pill before it gets through. And also, you still have to go through question of bowel cleansing. You still have to go through that prep in order to be able to see with the pill. So, but it may be out there down the road.
And our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Journalist Alyssa J. Rubin spent most of the last 10 years reporting on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. She's now the Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. On the next Fresh Air, she talks about disturbing trends in Afghanistan, the prospects for peace in Iraq, and how September 11th changed her life. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the future of the U.S. space program with Louis Friedman, Dr. Louis Friedman. He is, in fact, a Ph.D. doctor. He's an aeronautics engineer. He is executive director emeritus of the Planetary Society. Also, we'll have some more programs from the Deep Archives. This is something that we started doing back in the beginning of the year to celebrate the fact that this show has been on the air now 30 years. And we have gone back and dug into our archives, pulled back some shows that are not on the electronic archives we have. And in many cases, these are shows that have not been heard since they were first broadcast. We picked out some people we thought were interesting, in some cases controversial, and organized them around a particular theme. Tomorrow morning, we'll talk about the right to die and physician-assisted suicide. And one of the things that you will hear is an interview that I did back in the 90s with Dr. Jack Kevorkian. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Our guest in this hour is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic, and we're talking about GI issues. And if you have a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller, somebody in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was going to ask about C. difficilis, and you mentioned it, so I thought I'd ask you to elaborate a little bit on it. I've never heard of it before. My father was on extended regime of antibiotics, and we heard about it there, and then I was on an antibiotic, and I saw it in the write-up on precautions, and I've never really noticed it before. Maybe I read my precautions more than I used to or something. But I also have a colonoscopy coming up, and I'm wondering, how long would I have to fast to avoid having to take the stuff that has varied through the time? I think I've used like four different kinds of preps in the last four times.
So let me answer the last question first then, if that's all right. So you want to try and not take the prep at all?
Well, I don't know. Well, I was just inquiring.
Yeah.
Most people like dislike that more than they like dislike the with the amnesiacs you take. You don't remember the.
Yeah, you're right. The prep is the worst part of the whole thing. Unfortunately, the prep kind of cleanses things so that you don't have thick mucus still left on the wall of the colon when you're having the exam. So just fasting, even if you were on clear liquids for a week, you might still not have a wonderful prep to see fine details of the colon. I hate to share that with you. But so I would encourage you to take the prep.
Right. Well, fasting for a week would be unpleasant, too.
Yes, I would agree with you. The second question, Clostridium difficile is a bacteria that's traditionally been found to occur after someone's undergone a course of therapy of antibiotic for some other reason. And it's just out there. But, of course, people that are in the hospital when they get the antibiotics because of where a lot of antibiotics are used there, therefore there's probably more of the C. difficile bacteria hanging around, have a slight increased risk of that.
But is it normally present? It's just the one that goes on balance that it shows up, or is it something that you really is a contaminant that you have to get from somewhere?
Well, it probably is a normal bacteria that hangs around in some, quote, carriers. How's that, unquote? And that don't actually have, you can have the bacteria around as long as it doesn't secrete the toxin, you won't get the colitis from it. So I'm sure that there are probably a lot of carriers out there, and even healthcare workers that carry the bacteria from one person to another because of poor hand washing techniques or whatever, that then can give it to someone that now is getting antibiotic for something, and now they're prone, they're already sick from something else, and now they're prone to getting this bacteria. What we have seen, however, over the last 10 to 15 years, we're seeing it more often, which is probably why you're now seeing a warning on your antibiotic labels that you didn't see before, because we didn't see it that often before. It was out there. Everyone was taught about it. But now we're seeing it more often, and I'm even seeing it in patients that have not been on an antibiotic within the last 6 months, which is usually what we say with as far as a potential risk problem. And it, whether that's from antibiotics that are used in meats predisposing to this, exposure in foods that we didn't have before, I don't know. But we know that it's a problem. We also know that it's not being, it's not secreting the typical toxin as often, or at least not at first. So we're having problems with our traditional test of picking up the fact that it's even there. So whereas one test was usually enough to say, yeah, it's there, it's not, I'm sometimes repeating the test 3, 4, 5 times if I think there's a high likelihood to see if it's actually there or not. We're also finding that it's coming back more easily in patients that have been treated with an antibiotic that should be able to take care of it. Those antibiotics are either metronidazole, Flagyl is the brand name, or vancomycin, that it's either not responding to the metronidazole, which is usually the first antibiotic of choice, or it's coming back after you stop the antibiotic. We're having a little bit harder time getting rid of it. And have to use repeated courses of medicine.
Are there any antibiotics? I know that Ceptra apparently is effective against it, but it's kind of got some brutal side effects for people, and some people have allergic reactions. Are there other antibiotics that are effective against C. diff?
Ceptra is not usually one of those, actually.
No.
No, sulfaba antibiotics are not active against the C. diff. But metronidazole, it traditionally will work, and it works at least 80% of the time, if not more. And then vancomycin, which is used more second line simply because the cost is just horrendous. But oral, and it has to be oral treatment. IV vancomycin does not work because it does not get it secreted.
Yeah.
And although a minute amount of IV metronidazole or Flagyl does get secreted through the biliary system into the gut, it's not enough to be effective. So it's got to be antibiotics that are used orally in order to get down to the colon to have any effect.
I'm sorry, well, you said Flagyl, and what was the other one?
It's metronidazole is the generic name for Flagyl, and vancomycin is the other antibiotic. There are some others that have been out there, bacitracin, rifaximin. There's some new antibiotics that may have some effect. They're out there, but they're not usually first-line therapy.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Again, other questions? 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. Just one more question here about screening for colon cancer. When I had my first encounter when I turned 50, my doctor said, well, okay, here's you pays your money and you take your choice. You can have a flexible sigmoid oscopy, or you can go the full route and have a colonoscopy. And for some reason, I said, hey, let's just do the sigmoid. And I think we've actually talked about this, and it seemed to be your feeling that, well, really, you ought to go all the way. Is now pretty much, do people even get offered flexible sigmoid anymore?
I've not seen very much of it. There are still guidelines out there that say you can do a sigmoidoscopy every 3 years with a bare minimum at least every 5 in order to stay on top of the screening. But the wrench that has been thrown in is that we're seeing more and more right-sided colon polyps that they therefore don't get to with the sigmoidoscopy. A barium enema is just not quite as good as a colonoscopy for picking things up. So things can be missed, especially on the right side. So it's if you've got the choice, it probably makes more sense to go with the full colonoscopy simply because you're going to be picking those polyps up and hopefully a little bit better exam, more sensitivity for picking things
up.
And
less you do get often. To go. Yeah, you get to. You don't have to. Then when you have it, you don't have to go again for another 10 years.
Right.
Yeah, assuming that everything's
if that part of you is perfect. Yeah,
that's right. Okay. Maybe let me ask you a question about reflux disease, about heartburn. That's something we have certainly talked about before, and there seem to be an awful lot of people who experience it, and we have a lot of people who are taking medications for it. One thing that I just came across with a recent article where they felt that they had to actually test advice that says, well, to one of the things you can try to do to avoid heartburn if you have it at night is don't eat before you go to bed. And the standard advice, I think, was that three to four hours before you're going to lie down. And apparently someone actually tested that and they found, yeah, actually. How about that?
True.
It's a benefit. It's
yeah.
true. It's a benefit. You can lessen your chance of heart disease by not eating 3 or 4 hours before going to bed, which, you know, seems like a pretty good common sense thing, which then gets you onto this question, well, you know, short of taking medication, if there are people who do have a lot of trouble with heartburn, what sorts of things in terms of modifying their lifestyle, and we can put on the list, don't eat 3 hours before you go to sleep.
Yeah, right.
Are there some other particular things that are really easy to do where you would say to people, well, before you start thinking about taking medication, here's some stuff that you can do?
Sure. There, you know, some of it's common sense, I think, but we'll go over the stuff. Certainly, if you overeat, that puts more pressure on the sphincter muscle in the lower esophagus, putting more pressure on a muscle that may be weak anyway is just going to promote more problems. So eating smaller meals and just not taxing that muscle makes a whole lot of sense. And as much as I enjoy the conversation with the man who drinks hot coffee and spicy foods, the caffeine does lower the sphincter strength temporarily after you drink coffee. Anything caffeinated actually will do that, whether it's chocolate, strong tea, caffeinated tea, Mountain Dew, any caffeinated drinks, probably a lot of the energy drinks that are very high caffeine, they do relax that muscle, and so that promotes potential reflux. And then, of course, in acid, there's a lot of acid in coffee, even decaffeinated coffee. Now, the acid itself doesn't promote reflux. If things are already irritated, that's not going to feel so hot. Tomatoes and mint actually also are foods that have a chemical in them that relaxes that sphincter muscle as well and will increase the potential for reflux problems.
Mm-hmm. That's one of those things. I know I read about that a long time ago, that mint for some people is a problem.
Yeah.
That some people might think was sort of surprising, particularly because so many sort of remedies for upset stomach include mint.
Yeah, and it's interesting because if the upset stomach or the indigestion is being caused by an overactive system, so you're having a little bit too much contractions going on, it relaxes that. So, I mean, these are, again, old wives' tales / remedies from many, many years ago, but there was actually some reason that they worked. So, you know, if your upset stomach's because you're having reflux, the mint is just going to exacerbate that. But if it's because things are just kind of churning away, it may actually relax things.
All right. So another caller here, Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Good morning, Dr. Nugent.
Good morning.
I don't have any question. I just want to extend my gratitude to you for being my physician for the last 12 or 13 years and also as a fellow fitness center member. I just want to thank you for being there for us, and I appreciate all you have done for us.
Well, thank you very much. That was very nice.
All right. Thank you. Well, we have about, maybe 6-7 minutes left in this hour. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist. If you have questions about digestive issues, you can give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Back to reflux, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was about the medications that people take, particularly that class that includes things like Prilosec, the things that end in ol, like omeprazole and lansoprazole and all those other ols, those things that reduce acid production, and that actually are now available as over-the-counter medications.
Right.
You can just go down to wherever it is, you buy stuff like that, and you can buy it and take as much as you want. There seems to be some concern about the possible ill effects of very long-term use of these medicines. both in terms of what happens when people stop, and then other sorts of, you know, it does that, it does taking that for a long period of time increase your risk of other kinds of problems? What's your thought about these are, I guess these were, are these are the proton pump inhibitors,
PPIs? Right, and that's different from, I'll just make a distinction between medicines like Pepcid, Tagamet, and Zantac, which are antihistamine or histamine receptor blockers, H2 blockers. They also work against acid production, but aren't nearly as strong as the proton pump inhibitor classification. Let me talk about it. First, if you're taking a proton pump inhibitor like Prilosec or Prevacid, and I mean there's lots of them out there now, yeah. And if you're taking it very regularly for a long period of time, and I would say long period of time probably being more than 4 or 5 months, if you stop that medicine cold turkey, there will be a rebound in your acid production because they do a wonderful job at suppressing acid production. So to stop it suddenly, if you didn't have heartburn before, you will. if you just stop it all of a sudden. So I usually will tell patients if we are going to try to wean people off, to take it every other day for a while and then cut down a little bit more and just do it gradually so we don't have that rebound effect. As far as side effects of the medicines, there's some minor side effects. There are probably about 5 to 10% of patients can have diarrhea side effects with these medicines, and it probably is because we're blocking some of the agents that are important for some people, maybe to, and it, so that therefore promotes the diarrhea problems. There are some people that do have headache problems related. That's probably about 3 to 5%. And that's not just with long-term therapy. That's even with short-term therapy. And I've even seen some patients that, and it's listed as one of the potential side effects, is abdominal pain with these medicines. And not necessarily with all of them, but they take one and it causes more pain. But if they take a different one, it doesn't seem to cause the same effect. And I don't have a good explanation for that. But, again, someone once told me any medicine can do almost anything, so I respect that as well. As far as long-term side effects, there's been some issues associating osteoporosis with long-term proton pump inhibitor therapy, and the idea is that it decreases calcium absorption. And theoretically, it definitely could do that because calcium is better absorbed in an acid medium, and you're taking away that acid medium, and so it should decrease the calcium absorption. I have some issues with those studies because if you look at patients that have had gastric surgeries where there is no acid production, not even any kind of get through, where you might have a little bit of acid production get through with a proton pump inhibitor, those patients don't have an increased risk of osteoporosis, and you know their calcium absorption can't be quite normal. So I kind of wonder what exactly has occurred in those situations. But having said that, I usually tell patients, you know, if it decreases calcium absorption, just make up the difference with a calcium supplement, which we're promoting anyway. Mm-hmm. And usually that will be make up the difference. I also go back and look at, theoretically, for the same issues, it should, the proton pump inhibitor should decrease iron absorption because iron is also absorbed better in an acid medium. And again, if you look at the patients that have had stomach surgeries where they're not producing any acid, those patients over many years after their surgeries do become iron deficient. That does happen. We know that. And so you have to add more iron to make up the difference. This iron deficiency does not occur in long-term proton pump inhibitor therapy. So it's kind of interesting. Things are still out there.
How do you hear, now we're coming down to, we just have about a couple minutes, but let me just ask the question about surgery, because there now are some surgeries that are available, some procedures that are designed to tighten up that sphincter, the one between the esophagus and the stomach, so that so the acid is not going to get out and get up into the esophagus. How do you talk with people and have them think about whether they would at least want to think about taking that next step and having surgery?
Certainly the patients that have such severe reflux problems that we're having a hard time controlling it even with medicines, those, I think that's pretty straightforward. We're probably going more towards surgery now because the surgeries are being done for the most part laparoscopically, so it's much easier to recover from as opposed to the really large side incision that had to be done for the previous surgeries. Mm-hmm. The patients that do best with those surgeries are the patients that have a good response to the proton pump inhibitor therapy as well, even though it may be taking a lot of them in order to get the result. And that probably means that a lot of the symptoms may not just be from acid. It may be some other things causing some of the symptomatology. So it's partly up to the patient if they want to go through a surgery. Some patients just say, look, I don't want to take this many medicines all my life. I need to have something else done. And that's very, very reasonable. And some, for the most part, if the right patients are picked for those surgeries, they do very, very well. And the surgeries last often for at least up to 10 years. Not always, but many of them do. So those are things that I think about trying to decide who should go and who should not.
Okay. Real quick, we'll see if we can get one more call. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm glad the doctor is there and would like to ask her about taking gas relief pills like Phazyme and GasX. I have gas a lot, and I take those pills maybe twice a week. And I wonder what happens if you do that for a long time. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
I usually say if those things help, they're fine. They're probably better than anything any of us can prescribe for gas. And you're not doing any long-term damage taking them on a regular basis, especially just twice a week is not a big deal. There are certain things that you can look at, however, to see if the gas is coming from other things. The sugar substitutes are notorious for causing gas, especially things like xylitol and sorbitol, which are alcohol-based sugars. There's no alcohol in them, but they're produced from alcohol substances. And they're not absorbed by us, and therefore they cause tremendous gas problems. So that would be the first thing to look at. The other thing is some people do become lactose intolerant partially, and limiting milk product intake will sometimes help decrease the amount of gas. So kind of look at the boxes, the ingredients on the foods that you're eating, because that may help.
All right. There we'll have to stop with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Like Phazyme and GasX, I have gas a lot, and I take those pills maybe twice a week. And I wonder what happens if you do that for a long time. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
I usually say if those things help, they're fine. They're probably better than anything any of us can prescribe for gas. You're not doing any long-term damage taking them on a regular basis, especially just twice a week is not a big deal. There are certain things that you can look at, however, to see if the gas is coming from other things. The sugar substitutes are notorious for causing gas, especially things like xylitol and sorbitol, which are alcohol-based sugars. There's no alcohol in them, but they're produced from alcohol substances. And they're not absorbed by us, and therefore they cause tremendous gas problems. So that would be the first thing to look at. The other thing is some people do become lactose intolerant partially, and limiting milk product intake will sometimes help decrease the amount of gas. So kind of look at the boxes, the ingredients on the foods that you're eating, because that may help.
All right. There we'll have to stop with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. Thank you very much for being
Thank
here.
You. It's a pleasure.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Truppen, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
And that is it for us here on Focus. We want you, however, to stay tuned because there will be more in the way of news and sports and features and weather and a lot of other things all coming up here as part of the Afternoon Magazine and the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3. Urbana, 1 minute before noon Central Time. In Kansas City, September wheat trading at 824, down 18. December, 846 and a half. down 12.5. September wheat in Chicago, down 11.5 at 703.25. The December contract down 13.5 at 738. September corn, 725, down 11.5. December, 736.25, down 11.75. March, 748.25, down 12.5. May, 755.5, down 12.25. September soybeans, 1403, down 8. November, 1417.5, down 3.25. January, 1428.25, down 3.25. March, 1433.5, down 3.75. September meal, 366.30, that's down 90. September soybean oil, 57.79, down 39. October live cattle, 118.70, up 105. December, 118.85, up 15. October feeder cattle, 134.35, down 40.